Well, it's good to be back this morning. Adjust that a little bit. Were we expecting rain this time of year? Is this a... I guess it does, but still, I kind of enjoy it. We'll put that over here. If you'll be turning in your Bibles, I want to go back to Isaiah chapter 40 again. I spoke on a few verses from Isaiah 40 a couple of months ago when I was here. And I thought, we didn't do the whole chapter, and actually kind of the part, the second half or second two-thirds, maybe we're more familiar with even. But I thought this has some thoughts in it that I think are very relevant to us, even though the situation that Isaiah is dealing with here is a very, very different situation from what we face. But I think there's just some important thoughts here that we need to keep in mind, whatever our situation is. It's all about perspective, if you will, perspective. So let's just dive right in. I don't want to waste any more of your time than I have to. I guess I should say it was good to see several of you at, I still call it the Bible lectures. They want to call it Harbor. Okay, they can call it what they want to. I'd like to call it Bible lectures. Oh, this is being taped. I better watch out. Oh, anyway, no, I thought it was a good time. Anyway, so in Isaiah 40, I'm going to start in verse 12. We'll break this up a little bit because it's about 20 verses long before we're done with it. And the farther along we go, the more you'll recognize. But I started counting. By my count, in the span of 20 verses, there are about 16 questions that are raised here. And if I were Jeff Walling, I would do this, you know, give something and you guys respond, at least for the beginning. Maybe we'll go ahead and try that. I'll play Jeff Walling for a little bit here. And but we need to realize, the context that the Israelite people are in when Isaiah is speaking to them here. Everyone that I've read said that this is Isaiah addressing people when they are in exile, when they have been defeated by enemies from Mesopotamia. Assyrians, Babylonians have come and decimated the nation of Israel. And so, as you can imagine, for the people of God, that's a talk about changing your world, challenging the way that you have seen things. There's a whole bunch, I'll bring in a few things, there's a whole bunch that you know, would help us get into the sense of almost betrayal, certainly questioning. Ezekiel, for example, think of Ezekiel 37. You know the famous prophecy that Ezekiel gives about how he has this vision of a valley full of dry bones. You remember that one? He prophesies as God tells him to, and the bones come together and create new bodies and come to life, and they go marching off as an army. But maybe the part you don't remember is right at the end of that, is when he says, okay, so the reason why I'm talking about these dry bones is that's the way you people feel. You feel like your bones are dried up, that your hope is gone. See, so they're a hopeless people. They have no future. Or I think also, this one just came to me as I was driving in this morning. I don't know why I didn't think about it sooner, but think about Psalm 137. Do you know this one? This is a sad, there's a real bite to this psalm, Psalm 137, that begins with the famous line, by the rivers of Babylon. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and we wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplar trees we hung up our harps. For there our captors, the Babylonians, asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. Come on, be happy, folks. You can tell they're ridiculing, they're mocking the Israelites that they've conquered. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. And the writer responds, how can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. And on he goes. How can we be happy in a place like this? This is not our home. Several passages talk about how they've been taken to a place where the people speak a different language. And so they are subjugated by people they don't even understand, who, you know, are barking orders at them, getting mad at them for not doing what they're being told to do. And part of it is they don't understand what they're saying. And now these people who have conquered them are saying, come on, be happy, sing us one of your songs, do a little dance for us, show how happy you are to be here in Babylon, ha 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 ha. And that's what the people are going through. So they're despondent. They're losing hope. They think there is no future. They think this is the way they're going to end. Back to Ezekiel, they're thinking of Babylon as their graveyard. This is where they're all going to die. And so it's to that context that Isaiah is speaking. Beginning in chapter 40, Isaiah 40, beginning in verse 12. And where he starts, well, let me tell you where he's going, I think. The big verse, I think, in this passage is really verse 27. I think that's what he's really responding to. Because here's where he says what they are saying, what his audience is saying, verse 27. He says in verse 27, why do you say, O Jacob, why do you complain, O Israel, and say, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. See, in other words, why is God ignoring us? Doesn't God care? That's the question. Doesn't God care? I'm struggling here. I'm hurting here. I'm being ridiculed here. I'm being punched around here. And there seems to be no end in sight. No one seems to care. No one's coming to the rescue. There's no knight in white armor coming up on his horse to rescue us. Where is God? And so here's what Isaiah says, starting in verse 12. Let's read four or five verses here. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? Or with the breadth of his hand has marked off the heavens? And you're supposed to respond, no one. Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket? Or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? No one. Who has understood the mind of the Lord or instructed him as his counselor? No one. Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? Who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge and showed him the path of understanding? No one. Now, I'm going to get geeky here for just a second. All right. It's obvious what Isaiah is doing here is saying, look how huge God is. And trying to, you know, give you some perspective on how big God is. And I think the translations do a pretty good job of that. I mean, think of this. First of all, who has measured the waters? What's he talking about? In the hollow of his hand. The oceans. Not just, you know, Lake Superior, but all of the waters on the earth, right there, in this little cup of his hand, right? Who, in the breadth of his hands, has marked off the heavens. How big is everything? God can hold his hands out and says, about that big. All of the heavens. All of the heavens. All right. Now, so the part where I'm going to get geeky is the next line. Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket? Well, that's an interesting translation. It's a good guess. Because we don't really know what he's saying there. The word for basket is based off of the Hebrew word for the number three. And so they go, what do you mean? Held all the dust of the earth in a three what? So the usual idea, at least the one that I've heard, is that this is saying like a third of an ephah, like a third of a bushel. But we really don't know. Well, a few years ago, I was at a conference, and most conferences, they can be pretty geeky, you know, and they can get off into kind of inane things. But there was one guy did a paper on this line, and I thought that what he said made sense. It fit the context better. What does he mean by it's measured, what does he say here? Get it right. Who has held the dust of the earth in a three? And he says, if you look at this, you're talking about someone who's measuring stuff on scales. You know, you're at the open market. You're at the bazaar. You're buying your spices. And so how much are you going to get? Well, you have to measure it out and just, you know, pay a little bit for this spice or something. So what would be with three? And what he said is, he thinks that what's going on is you're trying to show how small it is. So what can you, ladies, maybe I shouldn't say ladies, but when you're cooking something and you want to just put a pinch of a spice in the dish, how do you do that? You pick it up between your thumb and the third finger. You just pick it up and sprinkle that on there. In the same way when you're buying it, you know, you only want X amount, we got a little bit too much. You just take a pinch off or you add a pinch on. And the guy said, I think that's what is going on here. That the dust of the earth is so tiny that for God, he can get it all and hold it as a pinch between his thumb and third finger. Wow. That makes sense. It fits how big they're making God here. If you can hold the waters of the earth in the hollow of your hand, surely the dust, you know, and what, the earth is 3/4 water. The dust is even less. All of the dry land of the earth fits between God's thumb and middle finger. Wow. That's getting some perspective, right? Okay, so I said I was getting geeky. I'm done with being geeky. Who has understood the mind of God? Who has advised him? Who has said, you know, have you ever thought of this, God? Maybe you should, what? What are you going to say to God to say, have you ever thought of this? Of course he's thought of it. How ridiculous is that? But you got to remember who these people, you know, who they're facing. These are people who have been conquered by someone else. And that someone else is saying, oh, you think your God is so great. We just defeated you. How great can he be if we just wiped out your nation the way that we just did? Legitimate question. Depends on how you go about rating God, right? So this is about perspective. Again, I think of another passage. I've probably mentioned this one before, but just in case. What about Psalm 115? Do you know Psalm 115? It starts off, not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name be the glory because of your love and your faithfulness. Why do the nations say, where is their God? Where is Israel's God? Why do they say that? I can tell you why they said it. Because, like the Babylonians, they just went in and they conquered Jerusalem. When they got to the temple, they took out everything that's inside. And guess what? There's no idol inside. What? The Israelites don't have a god? If they had a god, surely they'd have an idol to represent that god, right? No. And the answer is, well, what do you mean, where is their god? Our God is in heaven, thank you very much. He does whatever pleases him. Their idols, the idols of the nations, they're silver and gold, made by the hands of men. Yeah, they've got mouths, but they can't speak. They have eyes, but they can't see anything. They have ears, but they can't hear. They have noses, but they can't smell. And on it goes. See, so that's the Israelite response. You got to get perspective here. Now let's go on in Isaiah 40 and notice what he says then. He's been asking all of these questions. Whom did the Lord consult? Who showed him the path of understanding? Verse 15. Surely the nations now are thinking they're really big stuff. Who are the nations? Surely the nations, they're like a drop in a bucket. You think you're so big. You're just a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. This is the stuff you need to wipe off so you can put the stuff that you want away. You see that? He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon, the biggest forest that they know of, is not sufficient for altar fires. You can't offer an offering big enough to have God take notice. Nor are there animals enough for burnt offerings. Before him, all the nations who think they are so big and powerful, they are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless, less than nothing. So here's twice now he's going to ask these questions. To whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? See, this is what is so silly about what the other nations do. Is they try to make an image that is comparable to God. So you get some idea of who God is. And they're saying, that's just silly. Whatever you might use is not going to be sufficient. It's going to be, in some ways, a slap in the face, a mockery of God to say, oh, he's like this thing. Or like, even if you make him like a human being, the greatest of all creatures. Oh, that's... No, he's so much more than that. And so then they make fun of how you make an idol. As for an idol, you get a craftsman who casts it. A goldsmith overlays it with gold, fashions it with silver chains. Someone who's too poor to present such an offering picks the wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman, someone who will set up an idol so that it won't fall over. See? Can't even keep itself upright. That's what you're looking for, something that will stand. Well, as if. Don't you know? Haven't you heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning, he says? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He, God, sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. People are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy. He spreads out the heavens like a tent to live in. And now notice what he does. He brings princes, brings the highest of people to naught, to nothing, and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner did they take root in the ground that he blows on them and they wither. A whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. They used to be so big and powerful and mean-looking, and they're just gone. That's the way it is with God. So to whom will you compare me? Who is my equal, says the Holy One? And the answer is no one. Not even these big, bad ugly Babylonians. So lift up your eyes, look to the heavens. Who created all these? He brings out the starry host one by one, calls them each by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. So now we get to the question. So why do you say, O Jacob? Why do you complain, O Israel? My way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. Don't you know? Haven't you heard? Have you not been listening? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow weary or tired. His understanding no one can fathom. You can't put a number on it. You can't quantify it. You can't measure it. There is no measure. He gives strength to the weary, increases the power of the weak. Youths grow tired and weary, the best of us, the ones that are in the greatest shape, they grow tired and weary. Young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint. So here's where I think we can really understand how, even though we are not in their situation, we are not struggling with what they are struggling with, still, we struggle. We get tired. We grow weary. Now, they're facing, you know, I can't even think of the right word for it, but you know, I guess it's a crisis of faith. Should they believe in their God or not? Because it looks like that the Babylonians and the gods of the Babylonians are much more powerful than their God. That's the way it looks. That's the way the evidence is pointing at the moment. And Isaiah is saying, no, you got to take a step back and get a bigger perspective here. But that's what they're wrestling with. And he's saying, trust in God. Remember what you've been taught. You've got to see this, not just by what's happening right here in this little part of the world right now. You've got to take a step back and see the bigger picture. And then trust that God is in charge. Think back in your history when things have been bad before. Hasn't God come through? Yes, over and over and over again. And he will again here. Just trust in him. Now, what do we get tired of? How do we get weary? And how do we show our weariness? Well, I think, come at it from this perspective. How is our faith, and I'm talking in a very, very basic sense, how is having faith in God challenged today? All right, there's a whole bunch of things that we could talk about, but one very basic argument that you hear from the atheist agnostics is, how can you say there's a God? When, what? Well, for God to be God, I love this, for God to be God, he has to be all-powerful and he has to be all-loving. I love it when humans go around defining who God is and what he has to be like. But that's what they say. He has to be all-powerful and he has to be all-loving. And yet, we suffer, and in particular, they want to point out, innocent children suffer. How can a God who is all-powerful and all-loving let innocent children suffer? Either he's not all-powerful and he couldn't stop it, or he's not all-loving and he didn't care that they suffered, right? Right? So So the where they're wanting to lead you by simple logic is, if innocent people suffer, innocent children suffer, then there must be no God. End of story. Let's move on with our lives. I don't know if many of you at Harbor at the lectures, if you got to hear David Wolpe, the Jewish rabbi from here in the LA area. I didn't get to hear him there. I've heard him before at Pepperdine. I really like his kind of straightforward, simple answer to those kinds of questions. Okay? Number one, he says, if all we ever experienced was good, right? I mean, that's what the Richard Dawkins of the world, the atheists, want us to think. If there's really is a God, he must be all-powerful and all-loving, which means we should only experience good. Otherwise, there's no God. Right? He says, but if all we experienced was good, based on our experience as human beings in our short lives, what would happen if all we experienced was good? We would take it for granted. That's the way we are. That's the way we are. We would take it for granted. We would not recognize where it comes from. If you can't see God and you can't see Him doing it, then you're going to just start saying, oh, it just happens. It just happens. And if all we experienced was good, that would not create more faith. That would just create a sense of, oh, we're going to have good. End of story. And there's no faith. And then he also goes on to say, so what some people say should happen is, you should only suffer if you do wrong. That God should bless you every time you do right, and He should punish you every time you do wrong. Then God would be fair, right? And what is more, if you do a little wrong, there should be a little punishment. If you do a bigger wrong, there should be a bigger punishment. And on you go. He says, now, what if it really worked that way? So every time you did something good, there would be an immediate positive blessing response from God. And what if every time you did something wrong, there was an immediate proportionate punishment from God? Guess what would happen? You would probably do right most, if not all of the time, but for what reason? So that you would have good. When what God wants is for you to honor Him and be in relationship with Him. But if your motivation is, what am I going to get out of it? That's not what God is aiming for. And so, yeah, it's messy. Theology is messy. But simply to say, well, if there's bad in the world, if there's suffering in the world, there's no God. No. That's to have a human model of the way God should be, the way we'd like for Him to be, perhaps, so that it would be easy for us. But that's not the world, and that's not the God that we know, right? So that's one thing. Think of how that how Isaiah then responds to that. If there were a God, if He really was sitting above the world, He wouldn't have let this happen to the Israelites, right? Certainly He wouldn't have let some bad nation like the Babylonians do this to them, right? So he's not in charge, right? No, He is. But He's working it out according to His terms, with His ultimate goal in mind. And our job, if you will, is to trust Him, to rely on Him. But boy, it's hard to do that. It's hard to keep doing that sometimes. Now, where my mind goes is, what do we get tired of? What makes us weary? And my mind goes to two passages in the New Testament from Paul, one in Galatians 6 and one in 2 Thessalonians 3. And they both have basically the same line, which is, don't grow weary of doing good. Don't get tired of doing good. Right? So the passage in Galatians, if you look in Galatians 6, verses 9 and 10, he's leading up to that by saying we have this inclination in us either to do things according to our nature, according to our physical desires. Go to Romans 7 as well. According to our physical desires, which is in conflict with what our spirit, which our soul, our conscience is telling us to do. And because of this constant struggle, we just often think, oh, it'd be so much easier. It'd be so much more pleasant. It'd be so much funner if we did what our body is telling us to do rather than listening to what our spirit is telling us is the right thing to do. So he says, don't grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we don't give up. See, now that's the thing, is often we do good, but it's the doing of it over and over and over again that must be done. That after a while, we want a break, right? I kind of laugh, I do laugh, at some of the students I have who say, wow, Dr. Willis, you know, I've been working really hard in your class. I mean, I devoted 10 hours to it this week. I think I deserve a break now. You know, I've been working so hard in class. We should get a day off. Really? You've been working, I know, you've been working harder than any human being ever alive before has worked. And how quickly young people seem to feel like they need a break. They need a vacation. You know, just after the littlest effort in my mind sometimes. But it's a sign of how, as humans, we get tired. We get tired. But he says, don't get tired of doing good. Don't get tired of doing good. The other passage, 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, in verse 13, he's been talking about how there are some there in the church in Thessalonica who are what he calls busybodies. They're just going doing whatever kind of captures their imagination at the moment. But for the most part, they're just sitting around. They're being idle. They're sitting back waiting for something fun to come their way, I guess. But he says, but you don't be like that. Don't be idle. Don't grow weary in doing good. So what makes us weary? What tires us as we strive to do good? Okay? As we strive to do good. I mean, for one thing, it's having to do it over and over and over again. Let's start with something basic. Cleaning up the kitchen. You know? Yeah. Or the bedroom, or the bathroom, or whatever part of the house you're talking about. We all know if you don't do it on a regular basis, it gets worse and worse and worse. But just thinking, oh, well, yeah, people, we want to have people over, but I've got to clean the house. And so sometimes we can get weary of that. We get tired of having to do that. The dust keeps coming back. We got to keep pulling out the vacuum cleaner or the brooms, you know, or the dust over and over again. Yeah. So sometimes it's just that. But sometimes also, you know, it gets, we can kind of run into the situation that we saw there in Psalm 137. You're doing something good, something that needs to be done, but other people make fun of you for it. You know, rather than going out and having a good time with some of your friends, you say instead, no, I've got a commitment to helping this shut in, or I've got to take care of this responsibility at my home or wherever. And they go, oh, come on, you're a party pooper. Come on, you know, you need to get out and live it a bit more. No. You're doing good. This is something that needs to be done, and you're there to do it. Don't get tired of doing that. Often, I think, I've seen where I've done something good, and then almost immediately somebody comes around and undoes what I've done. You know. As I've matured, I've gotten to where I don't get mad at them. You know, I've just got things the way that they should be. And then somebody comes in and, oh, yeah, the kitchen is all clean. Oh, my goodness, you're going to cook another meal? I just had all the dishes done. The spices were back where they belonged. The towels were hung just right over the edge of the oven. And now, honey, what are you doing? I'm cooking dinner. But I just didn't even say thank you. Well, of course. You know? So why do I keep cleaning up if you're just going to mess it up again? But there's a lot that needs to be done. Don't grow weary of doing good. Think about, I'm glad Jan's not here, but here we go. One of the things that I do, as you know, Jan is a high school English teacher. Wow, that's a job. That's a job. Those of you who know teaching know that teaching is a job. Something like English and other things where there's a lot of writing and all involved, that's a job. It's very typical for Jan to come home at the end of the workday, and I can tell she has just been getting stuff from students, from administration, whatever, you know, something new that has to be done, some student who's come up with the lamest excuse ever for why the assignment wasn't in on time or why they didn't do it according to, whatever. But she has been just using a whole bunch, expending a lot of energy on responding in a kind way to this. You know, treating people with respect who are not doing the same toward her. And so she comes home and basically just regurgitates it to me. And if I'm going to do good, I'm going to listen to that. And I'm going to side with her and sympathize with her and encourage her to go back for more punishment tomorrow. But there are times when I'm just tired. I don't want to hear it tonight, Jan. I just, you know. And she can sometimes see me rolling my eyes. I've heard this story before. I can't grow weary. I can't get tired of doing good. Think about, I don't know, at your job, the good that you do for your coworkers, for the people who either who work above you, below you, beside you. That's what makes working good. You know, as much as you're there to do a good job. Notice Paul doesn't say, don't grow weary in doing a good job, which we shouldn't do. But it's don't grow weary in doing good. So in addition to the job, in addition to what you get paid for at work, you do good for your fellow workers. You treat them as human beings. You show them kindness, forgiveness. You help out when they need it. You give them a shoulder to cry on if that's what's needed. And sometimes, you know, some of the people we work with are not easy to work with. You ever heard that line before? So-and-so is just not easy to work with. Yeah. But you do. Don't grow weary. I think about raising kids or taking care of, in my case, taking care of aging parents or whatever. Some of us get to do that long distance. Some of us get to do that day in and day out. You know? It can be tiring. You can get weary. Yet again, I've got to, what, change a bedpan, change the sheets, clean up this or that. I didn't sign up for this. But you do it over and over and over again, right? Maybe it's your sister, maybe it's your brother. But that's just what you do. And it's easy to get tired and to gripe about it and to complain about it. But don't grow weary in doing good. I think about the people that we run into at the grocery store, at the drugstore, you know, at the DMV, after waiting in a long line. It's easy to get weary. You know, I don't know if I ever told you the story. When my daughter Megan got her driver's license, it took us 10 trips to the DMV for that to happen because of the different paperwork and other things that came up along the way. You know. Just do it. Don't grow weary in doing good. Show kindness. Show respect to your fellow human being. On and on we go. Last example I'll give. I know I mentioned this many, many years ago because this happened many, many years ago, but I remember being struck as a... When I was in graduate school in Abilene, Texas, I worked on the weekends as a youth minister at a small town about half an hour or so south. So if you're half an hour south of Abilene, Texas, you are in the middle of nowhere. Small town. But one of the widows passed away while we were there. Her name was Edna May. And in the next week or so after that, we got 5 phone calls at the church building asking, who's going to bring my groceries now? Now that Edna May is gone. None of the 5 widows, 5 shut-ins, none of them members of our congregation. And yet she was going to them every week, getting a grocery list, going to the grocery store, buying their groceries, and bringing it to their house. And they assumed this was something the church had put her up to. No. She was just doing it. Into her 80s. She never got tired of it. And I've always admired that. See, here's part of the deal then with this passage. We as Americans... We like to think we can fix things. We like to think whatever's going on, we can figure it out and fix it. No matter how big the problem might be. We're going to be smart enough. We're going to try hard enough. We're going to be diligent enough. And we're going to be right enough that we're going to fix it. And so we look to people who can do that. You know, whenever something comes up in our country, what do? Okay, call in the experts. Let's find out what they say. Somebody who knows a lot of the data, they can pull it all together. We can work it out. We can fix this, right? And that's what is our job, is to fix everything. We are the nations. See, we've almost gotten to the point where we think, yeah, we don't need God. We can do it without Him. Not true. Not true. All we can do is a little bit of good. Each and every one of us. I mean, we can work it. Bigger problems. But ultimately, those are all in the hand of God. Ultimately. And that's what we need to remember. It's very easy for us to do then, try to start doing a little bit and then think, oh, this is not going to make any difference. What is my little bit over here? It's not going to make any difference. Yes, it will. Do not grow weary in doing good. God notices. You know, the writer there in Isaiah says, what? Doesn't he notice what's going on? Doesn't he care? Yeah. He notices. So trust in him. Rely on him. Hope in him. Those who wait on the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint. But the first thing you have to do is submit to God. Realize he is the one in charge. He is the one who sits enthroned above the earth. He is the one who can hold everything, every problem, in the palm of his hands as something between his thumb and middle finger. He's the one. We want to take care of the big picture. No, that's God's job. Our job is to do the little things, the day-to-day, one-on-one, good. So the first thing you got to do is submit to him. Realize that you need him. You need his strength. What you're doing in the good you're doing is living out his will in your life. That submission starts with baptism, the dying to ourselves. That's the recognition that the life that we live comes from him, through him, is his gift to us. So it starts with baptism and confessing our faith in him, not ourselves, not in something else, solely in him. And then living our lives out to glorify him, or as the song we're about to sing says, consecrated to him in every way to glorify God. So I know I've talked a bit longer than usual. If you haven't been baptized, if you haven't given your life to God, please consider it today. And if you have, and you feel kind of tired, if you're kind of going through the week wondering, is this all really worth it? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Don't worry about the big picture and solving all of the world's problems. Look at what God has placed in front of you to do. And do it. Do the good. With all your might, without giving up, despite feeling tired, despite feeling weary, look to him and regain your strength from him. Let's think about that as we all stand together and sing. Was it 669? 669.